Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 173 on the U.S. economic forecast for 2021 with Paul Sloat. If you're into real estate investing and building wealth, congratulations, you are in the right place. The REI Diamond Show is a wide-ranging conversation of all things real estate investing. My role here on the REI Diamond Show is to seek out and invite guests who specialize in building wealth, such as real estate investors and other industry service providers, and then to draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars or more in the business of real estate. And today's returning guest, Paul Sloat, also CEO of Green Drake Advisors. And as an economist with experience spanning more than four decades, Paul joins us here today to discuss what the economic environment might look like over the next 1 to 3 years, and also what we might expect over the next decade or so. And a little later in the episode, I also share my own four personal action items or insights on how I plan to capitalize on these coming economic trends. So stay tuned. Let's jump right in, shall we? All right. Paul Sloat, welcome back to the REI Diamond Show. It's been a few months here. I think it was early in the year that we had you on as our economist. So how have things been for you, Paul?
Well, things have been good. I've had an incredibly busy year, as you might guess. The market has provided significant opportunities to invest this year, especially when we had that collapse that was like 1998. And I managed to sneak out of the country in the middle of the pandemic and spend 2.5 months basically sitting on a beach in Turkey, which I thought was a pretty good thing.
Nice. Sounds like fun. Hey, Paul, aren't the Turkish beaches like not really sandy? I mean, they're all rocks. Can you go swim in there or what?
Oh, well, the water's great. It is rocky. It's very similar to what you have in Italy. The water temperature was lovely and warm. It was in the 70s into the end of September. So it's great swimming weather. And the temperature, the air temperature was up to 80 degrees or so every day. We were in the Aegean, so it was lovely. That was sort of in the southwest portion of Turkey there, not too far from the Greek islands. And the water is great. I would highly recommend it. Turkey is a beautiful country, by the way, has tremendous physical beauty, and the people are wonderful and warm and welcoming.
Nice. And for anyone listening that remembers Paul being a regular on the show, his hiatus from our show had some to do with that the economy the trip out of the country there going where it was going. But I do want to kind of start early in the episode, Paul, and I want to thank you sincerely. And maybe some of the listeners would also nod their head as I'm saying it, but over the past few years that you've been a guest on my show, obviously I've been buying and fixing up real estate, buying and selling, and Diamond Equity Investments has been growing. And when we hit, March 15th, March 21st, and we had the shutdown start to occur, one of the things we obviously had a lot of uncertainty during that period of time, but a lot of the confidence that I was able to have as a leader in my company and then to communicate to everybody on my team and even the people that are in my network who are buying houses, we were confident that the demographics favored single family real estate, even in the face of the uncertainty that we had with COVID-19. And luckily, you know, the first fears, at least I know I had, I'm sure a lot of Americans had in the country, was like, oh my gosh, if this COVID-19 thing suddenly flares up and is like overwhelmingly deadly to a degree, you know, like a lot of people have died now, but if we were dealing with like Ebola type death rates or something, which we didn't know if that was what was going to be the case early on, things were going to be a big problem. And for real estate investors, we would have had dramatically different problems than what we kind of had to deal with so far. And I don't want to like say that like I'm taking the pandemic lightly, and a lot of people are sick and we're going into a wave, and you know, it's not a pleasant thing at all, and a lot of people have passed away. But for real estate investors, even during those early, you know, first 3 months when the country was shut down, we kind of had this hanging on. But it was through our conversations about the economy and what was coming down the pike and demographics that helped me personally grow to kind of understand a lot more of the economic forces that might have played a role. And it allowed us as a company to continue investing very heavily in single family housing as a result. And we were able to come out of the shutdowns, and, you know, we're wrapping up 2020 here as we go into 2021 with it will probably be a 40 or 50% growth rate from last year from where we were, which is phenomenal on the heels of a 52% growth rate the year before that. So, you know, my sincere thanks, Paul, for sharing of the perspective of the economy here in America and around the world, because that's helped tremendously for me. So thank you, Paul.
Well, Dan, it's a privilege, and thank you for your kind words. I'm glad that my insights have helped you and many other people to make good decisions in the face of difficult circumstances. And so why don't we talk a little bit about where the economy is? So if we weren't having a pandemic and we actually looked at the economic statistics, you would say this is a classic economic recovery. Now, why do I say that? Because typically what leads out of a recession is housing and autos. And the other piece is you have a massive inventory correction going into the recession, and then you have a massive rebound in manufacturing and the need to rebuild inventories. And that is exactly what's happening in the economy. So from a classic economic cycle standpoint, if you were to predict we're an early cycle economy, we're coming out of a recession, exactly what you would expect to happen would happen. Now, there's a lot of other stuff going on out there that you have to be aware of. One is the Federal Reserve has been printing tons and tons of money, which will ultimately have an impact, and we'll talk about that later. And the other piece of this is that the federal government is running massive budget deficits, and that will have an impact, but we can talk about that later too. But outside of that, what's going on here is a classic economic recovery. And if you were to go back to 2008, 2009, or go back to 01, 02, for certain sectors of real estate, like hotels, what's happening now is not very different than what happened then. Occupancies plunged. Now, in this case, we had a recession and we had government-mandated shutdowns of those assets, and that's a problem, okay, near term. And we'll talk about what the opportunity might be in hotels. Malls, if we were to take a look at, malls are having real problems because people aren't going back to malls. They found they can shop online. I think you will get a rebound in traffic into retail once the pandemic is truly over, which means the second half of next year. But the real issue that the malls are facing, which is a fundamental issue, is there has been a massive shift going on for the last 20 years from physical retail to internet retail. And that shift is not stopping. So what will happen is that this asset class is going to continue to be under pressure even after we get a rebound in the economy and the ability of people to go out and enjoy their lives. And by the way, it's not just malls that have been infected by and hotels have been infected by the pandemic. It's other classes of real estate like mixed use, which a lot of mixed use have restaurants in them. People have not been going to restaurants. National Restaurant Association estimates that 20% of independent restaurants will go out of business during this pandemic. And I would not be surprised, because if you cannot either erect the tent outside in a parking lot to which you're attached in order to have outdoor dining with appropriate social distancing, or you have a big takeout business, as many of the ethnic restaurants do, you're in trouble. Because if you are a Fleming Steaks, for example, and your business is really white table, white glove linens, you can't get the people in the door. Or if your business is a crowded bar and you make all your money on alcohol, you have a problem. So I think that there will be a significant shrinkage in the number of restaurants. The restaurants that survive, though, will do very well once people feel comfortable going out again. And then, of course, in 2022 and beyond, there will be a significant number of new restaurants as people go back into the business, or people who had restaurants and had to shutter those restaurants because of the pandemic reliquify themselves and open again. So I think that you have a short-term issue in the restaurant business. In housing, as you know, Dan, I've been very positive on housing since the bottom in 2011. So I guess that's like a 9-year stretch. I've been positive. But as you know, in September, for those of you out there who read our monthly newsletter, and it's December, early December now that we're having this call, by the way, I turned neutral to negative on housing because I thought that the housing market had gotten a bit overheated. Prices had spiked a bit. Mortgage rates were being artificially held down. And foreclosures were being postponed. As we all know, normally in a recession, foreclosures go up because people get unemployed and they can't meet their mortgage payments. The interesting thing is, according to the latest statistics from the Mortgage Bankers Association, almost 9% of the homeowners with mortgages, and that's 48 million homeowners have mortgages, 9% of them are either behind or in forbearance. Two-thirds of them are actually in forbearance. So 9% of 48 million is 4.4 million homes. If those homes were to come onto the market at once, they would swamp the market, obviously, because we only sell 6.4 million existing homes in a good year and 1.2 to 1.5 million new homes in a good year. So next year, as the foreclosure moratorium goes away, there will be issues in the housing market as these homes are foreclosed and come to market. The other thing we need to keep in mind with the housing market is some of the artificial demand of people fleeing cities will go away, especially starting in the second half of next year as the vaccine is rolled out to the vast majority of the population and people feel comfortable being in the cities once more. The other thing that people don't talk about much, but that it has been in a number of the scientific journals about the pandemic, is even though we have 10.5 million people diagnosed with COVID, the actual spread in the population is anywhere from 10 times to 20 times the diagnosed number. Because this is an airborne virus, just like the flu, And therefore, we only diagnose a small fraction of the actual cases. So therefore, if the normal is 10 to 20 times, we're talking that at a minimum, over 100 million Americans have had the coronavirus over the past year. And that would be normal. So herd immunity may be closer than people think, and the vaccines are rolling out, so we expect some normality by the end of next year. The other thing with housing that we need to be careful with comes in the form of interest rates. The Fed has held interest rates down a bit, and so a long-term mortgage now is a little bit below 3%, 2.95% as of yesterday. If a 30-year mortgage returns to the midpoint of where it was for the last 10 years, and by the last 10 years, I mean from 2009 to 2019, the rate on the mortgage would be closer to 4%. That would represent almost a 15% increase in a mortgage payment for the same mortgage. And that's really important because the millennials are buying over half of the housing stock, and the millennials are taking out big mortgages to do it, just like the baby boomers did before them. So while that benefited this year because of the low mortgage rates, which pushed pricing, and because of the flight from the cities, which also added to demand, what you will see next year is you're going to see, at least for housing, I think a slowdown as the supply comes on of foreclosures, the supply of incremental houses from home builders, where orders are up over 20% year over year, comes to market. And at the same time, mortgage rates go up as the real economy recovers in the second half of next year, and mortgage rates go back to where they were before the recession. And so that's something to just keep in mind. You don't want to be holding a huge amount of inventory in houses come the second half, because you're probably going to have a slowdown. And also, you want capital available to buy some of the foreclosures that are going to come to market, because there will be opportunities to buy units at advantageous prices. So that's housing. In terms of rental housing, while we think there will be a bounce, as I stated on the show and as we had stated almost a year ago and before that in our public speaking, we had gone neutral on multifamily housing, and we expected them to have a problem as we went into recession, and typically multifamily does not do well in a recession. Valuations come down, and the cash flow comes down. So not only does the cash flow come down, the multiple of the cash flow comes down. But what we saw here was, because the Fed manipulated interest rates down, yes, the cash flow came down, but the multiples did not collapse as normal. We expect that as things normalize and as the banks no longer what we call pretend and extend, and actually foreclose on some of these buildings in some of the major metros, that will put some pressure on multiples of cash flow and push cap rates up a bit for multifamily. So there may be some opportunities next year as commercial foreclosures occur to buy some of these buildings at lower than normal cash flow because of evictions, because of unemployment, because of people fleeing the city to the suburbs. Try getting a rental in the suburbs, good luck. There's not much rental available, at least here in the Philadelphia suburbs. So as those trends sort of come to a bottom over the next year and some of these places go into foreclosure, you're probably going to have an opportunity to go buy some commercial real estate inexpensively. Let me think about what else real estate investors should keep in mind. We think there's a lot of pent-up demand on the travel side. So if there are hotels that you can buy at pretty attractive prices because somebody can't meet their bank debt and the bank's taken possession of the property. That would probably be a pretty good opportunity because come next year, there's a lot of pent-up demand for travel, and travel, in our opinion, will explode starting late next year once the vaccine's been rolled out. So that would be another area I think your listeners should keep in touch. Do we want to talk a little bit about President Biden and what his policies are going to be and how they might impact real estate investors?
Yeah, because I think there's some scary things that I heard when I took a look at some of his economic plans earlier before the election actually occurred, such as, you know, an attack on the 1031 exchange, amongst some other things. So maybe even a comparison of, you know, how it looked under the current administration's economic plan versus what it will probably look like if Biden gets in office and things go his way.
So the real question comes down
to
So the real question, I think, comes down to whether the Senate stays Republican or with a Republican majority is what I mean, or whether you end up with a Democratic win for both the seats in Georgia. That's considered a low probability event. So why don't we discuss what the likely outcome is given that you would have a split Congress with a Democratic president. So what I think will happen is they will agree on some basic things. In an interview with the New York Times that was published actually today, he made a very interesting comment because, remember, Joe Biden comes out of the Senate. Joe Biden's worked with Mitch McConnell, the current head of the Senate and Speaker of the Senate, and he knows how to work across the aisle. So he's not going to go for some of the things he would like to because he won't be able to get them through Congress. So what I think he's going to do is the 1031 exchange for now, I think is fine. I think the bigger issue will come down to, which is a much bigger issue, is the ability to transfer basis, okay? So let's talk about what I mean by that. So what happens, you make a 1031, you transfer basis, right? But what happens if you were to take that building and you die, your estate gets to mark it up and there's no capital gains tax on the markup, correct? There's no recapture tax on the markup. It just goes into your estate.
As it is now.
And the other thing is you can take that building and transfer it into a trust, right? And then the trust owns it, and it's not considered a constructive sale. Prior to Ronald Reagan, just so we should all be clear here, transferring assets into a trust was considered a constructive sale. Okay? So if you had a piece of depreciated property and you transferred it into a trust, you had to pay capital gains tax on the difference between the depreciated value and the fair market value. And you had to pay recapture up to your original basis, okay, which discouraged people from putting assets into trusts and ultimately made them taxable at death. So one of the things I think that would happen is I think the 1031 is too built into the economic structure of real estate for them to do away with it. It would really hurt the value of real estate and hurt the banking system, and I don't think they'll do that, at least up front. They may put some limits on it over time. I think the bigger thing that they will do is they will treat these assets as taxable at death, and they're also going to treat them as taxable as a constructive sale if they are transferred into either a new corporation or into a trust. And I think that that is going to have a much bigger impact because what happens is when an asset, a depreciated asset, is then transferred into a trust, it never gets taxed at death. So I think that that's one of the issues. The other thing that real estate investors will have to keep in mind is, as long as there's a Democratic president, all the Trump tax cuts, many of them, will sunset, right? Because they, in order to meet the Congressional Budget Office and OMB guidelines, they had to sunset certain tax provisions in the law after 10 years. Otherwise, they could never have argued. And you know, so you may have exactly what happened with the Bush tax plan, is that when you had Bush, you put in a tax cut, and then you had a Democratic administration, they just let it expire. So there are some provisions that were permanent, and there are some provisions that are going to expire. And so you have to pay attention and consult with your accountant as to that, but that's likely what's going on. Now, there are a couple of things I think that are going to be different under a Biden for real estate. Number one, the administration is very focused on social equity and universal affordable health care. So I think one thing is you will be paying more for your labor to fix up and do work for you, whatever you're doing on your real estate. So I think that's thing number one. But offsetting that, I think, will be a piece related to what they have titled, what was titled on President-elect Biden's website, what they call Renewing American Leadership, okay, and a Green New Deal. And part of this would be encouraging investment into the United States. And one of the ways to do this would be to have tax incentives for putting clean energy, for all kinds of things, whether it's solar, whether it's thermal heating and cooling, all kinds of things could end up getting certain tax incentives to encourage them to be used, either to the real estate investor or to the home owner. So I think that's something to watch, because I think that's something a bipartisan Congress could agree on. The Republicans would agree on a tax incentive scheme for solar power and certain other areas. What most people don't know is that Texas is one of the largest states for solar power, even though it's a Republican-dominated state. So I think that you could get something through Congress in real estate that supports the environment, but is more focused on incentives to put this in place and provide economic incentives for that. Those are the two things real estate investors should watch. The other thing that President Biden said, and he was quoted in a New York Times article today where he gave an interview of what he was proposing. And one of the interesting things, which will be a very consistent theme between President Trump and President-elect Biden, is the following. I want to make sure we're going to fight like hell by investing in America first. And according to the person who he interviewed, he ticked off green energy, biotech, advanced materials, artificial intelligence as areas ripe for large-scale government investment and research. And then he went on to say, I'm not going to enter any new trade agreement with anybody until we have made major investments here at home and in our workers and in education. So I would say that there's going to be a big push for basic R&D, for the construction of industrial plants here in the U.S. And as a result, there should be opportunities, significant opportunities, in industrial real estate. And I think that's true because the U.S., which most people don't know, actually manufactures less than 50% of the goods it consumes today. And this is unlike any other major economy, which tends to manufacture 80 to 90% of the goods it consumes. and close to 100% of critical goods it consumes. And I would expect that the U.S. economy is going to look like that in 5 to 10 years. And what President-elect Biden will do is alter President Trump's Make America Great Again into his Fight Like Hell by investing in America first. And so I think that that's kind of where things are headed and could become a major opportunity with industrial real estate and all the infrastructure and logistics that are going to go around with needing to move goods from point A to point B, whether it's warehousing, whether it's light manufacturing, whether it's retail, whether it's transportation. There's going to be a huge opportunity there. Is that helpful, Dan, for the listeners of the program? That's kind of where I see things going.
It is, and I've made some other investments outside of real estate. And one of the things, I turned 40 in 2020, so I feel like I've developed this little bit longer-term view when it comes to my investments. And so because I'm flipping houses, you know, my time horizon and window is usually 3 to 6 months out. I'm concerned with what the market's going to do 3 to 6 months out. Now, I've gotten stuck with houses I was trying to flip that I've owned a year, year and a half. They couldn't sell, 2 years, waiting for city permits, my job shut down. But that's the anomaly, and my average fix and flip is 3 to 6 months hold or less, right? And I strive to do that very quickly. So I've had this short-term time horizon for most of my real estate investing career. And now that I'm a little bit older than I was before, I feel like I've made peace with, and I sleep better at night by viewing all of my investments as a 3 to 5 year hold period at minimum. So when I buy stocks and I hang on to stocks, such as a couple of the green stocks that I've invested in when Biden, you know, was looking like the winner in the election, I started buying some things that kind of had these, you know, the AI and the green energy kind of things that would probably prosper under some of these things that you mentioned. But that 3 to 5 year time window horizon, that window of patience to hold any of my assets, if we're talking about stocks, you know, bonds, and even real estate. So real estate rentals of mine, Paul, my rental portfolio, when I buy, you know, an 8-10 unit building, whatever it is, a 3-flat, a single family house, I mean, it usually is like 3 to 5 years by the time I sort out the little portfolio piece and I get them to actually pay the rent. Hopefully, you know, I've got a couple of them that aren't now. And then after that window, the rents have raised. I've done that initial, you know, bout of maintenance or maybe renovations, and now they're kind of on autopilot and they keep going. And I'm leading up to give some context there, but I'm wondering if it's even realistic to ask this question. We talked a lot and today about what it will look like next year and at the end of next year. Is it even realistic to wonder how is the U.S. economy going to look in 3 to 5 years, or is that kind of a fool's errand to predict?
Well, here's what I think, okay? And I'm just going to use some broad generalizations here because I think that that's the easiest way to look at it. I think, you know, I've been investing, as you know, since the late 70s, early 80s. So I've been doing this longer. And for your listeners' interest, I will be 60 next year in 2021. But what I believe is fundamentally economic growth in the United States over the next decade is going to be higher than it was over the past decade. For a lot of reasons, there's many new technologies that have been in R&D that are coming to market, and these are all going to boost productivity growth, which has already started to go up. So I think one of the things we're looking at is a faster growing economy, fundamentally, and for good fundamental reasons. That's one, we have all these new technologies that are going to drive productivity growth. Number two, the U.S. can invest a lot in the economy to restore certain manufacturing areas back to where they should be. And I think that will occur, especially in the technology area. And I think that the third piece of this is we're going to have higher inflation over the next decade. Okay. Just so you know, historically, the U.S. vacillates between periods of very low inflation or deflation, right? And by the way, the 1930s weren't the only time when we had deflation. We had deflation back in the late 1800s in what's known as the Long Depression. So there have been periods of deflation or extremely low inflation. So if we go to the late 1950s, you know, from about 1954 onward up to the early 1960s, we had extremely low inflation in the U.S., much like what's gone on over the last decade. But what followed once you got into the late 60s and then the 1970s was much higher inflation. The likely outcome of all this money printing and the fact that the government's got a lot of debt on its balance sheet is going to be inflation. I think there's no way around it. Traditionally, the U.S. has gotten rid of its debt via inflation. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Because if you remember, under Ronald Reagan, when the economy grew really well, inflation was 4 to 5%. Under Bill Clinton, when the economy grew really well, inflation was 4%. So we can have really good growth with inflation. And the U.S. needs really good growth because it needs to now meet the challenge from China. So I think that's one thing. And then the other reason it needs really good growth is to maintain its economic standing in the world. And then the third reason it needs good growth is it needs to grow its way out in addition to inflate its way out of the massive amount of debt sitting on the U.S. economy's balance sheet. And I'm talking both government and non-government debt. The consumer is actually in good shape from debt, but the government is not, nor are major corporations, and inflation would solve many of the issues related to that debt if you could couple that with better real economic growth. Because imagine if the economy grew at 3% and you had inflation of, let's say, 3.5% or 4%, then you get 7% nominal growth. That means in 3 years, the economy's grown in excess of 20% on a nominal basis. And all of a sudden, $100 of debt against assets become $80 of debt against assets, or less. So I think there's a lot of reasons why we're going to have more inflation and more growth, and they all relate to the economic setup. So I'm actually quite positive because I see a lot of new technologies coming to the marketplace that are going to transform the U.S. in a good way. I know there's a school of thought out there, pushed by people like, you know, Jeff Booth, that, you know, all this technology is going to displace people. Unfortunately, if Mr. Booth apparently didn't study history, because we went through a period in the 1800s with massive, massive productivity growth of 5 to 6% as things like an engine, right, to drive a steamboat came out, or to drive anything else, cotton gins that were turned into factories for fabric. All kinds of things occurred in the 1800s that drove massive productivity and massive displacement of people. My favorite example is that in 1895, there were 250,000 plus blacksmiths in the United States. But by 1925, we only had 5,000. And so, but the economy grew at a very rapid rate. And so what I would say is that I see faster growth, more inflation, an economy where we're probably going to produce more of our own stuff, where technology, we're not going to allow to travel as much around the world as we have. So if we think it up here, it's going to be produced here. And I see also which would be past 2030, I think there's going to be a massive opportunity in space, which is something that my kids and my grandchildren will ultimately be able to take advantage of. But what I see coming based on all the pieces in process is a massive opportunity coming in space to commercialize space in a way that couldn't have been thought of years ago. And by the way, every time we've had a massive investment by the government in basic R&D for space, it's spun off hundreds of new technologies because we needed to solve problems we never solved before. And every one of those new technologies becomes a new industry. And so I'm just going to give you a little example. Something that everyone in the country uses on a regular basis and sits in their kitchen came out of the Moon program from the 1960s. And that thing is called a microwave. And so most people like me know this, but most younger people don't know this. The microwave came out of the space program. So what I would say is I see some difficulty because we're going to have to deal with debt. We're going to have a crisis in Medicare and Social Security again, just like we had back in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan, by the way. So this would not be the first crisis. And it's going to get solved through probably a bipartisan commission that ultimately says we're going to raise taxes. But outside of those things, I see faster growth, more inflation, a good economy for the entrepreneur, and an opportunity for Americans to see their living standards grow once again. So that's a brief summary of my view, given my perspective of having been around and watched the economy for the last 40, 50 years.
I appreciate that. And in closing here, as we wrap up, I'm going to share my four action items. And if you have anything to say afterward on those, that's great. But out of everything we talked about today, as you were talking, Paul, I made a bunch of notes here. And what I have is these four. So number one, we're potentially looking at, we're in the housing, a lot of bubbles end with this period of superheated, super active pricing, people buying. So the recent one that we did have was Bitcoin, right? As that thing went up to $20,000 2 years ago, everyone was getting in, and you kind of had all this like late, huge action, this high price action. Same thing with the internet.com bubble back in, 99, 2000 before it burst. And as we were looking at this last year, I was wondering the same thing. Man, this feels a whole lot like that very late stage kind of bubble activity a little bit. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if it is, and we're going to have this supply that's going to come online, let's say next year, into the year following from the foreclosures. And we also have a little bit of a pulled back to the present moment demand. So when we went into our low point, I think it was in 2012 when the tax credit finally expired, or 2010, my bad, when the Obama tax credit for first home buyers expired, we had this vacuum for like 2 months of existing home sales that went into a deep trough. And what we had actually happened during that was the tax credit pulled forward any of the demand from people who were like, hey, I'm thinking about buying a house in the next year or two. The demand was pulled forward to right now because the tax credit's going to expire. I better make everything move heaven and earth to get into the house now. And I think, as you described, the city flee kind of buyer, the millennials who are buying, anybody who is in a position to buy right now is buying because they want to lock in these historically low interest rates, a full 15% lower mortgage payment for the same priced house at the average rate. So the action item is, when we are in a slower market with more inventory, what I see typically personally in a single family housing space is that renovated houses of a high quality, they sell. And any kind of housing that's a little bit more dated, more of the handyman special kind of thing, suddenly when the supply comes on, foreclosures come on, usually these are houses that need work. So if we're in the single family space, flipping houses, fixing and flipping houses, the one thing that we can do to help mitigate our risk is to get in and out of the project as efficiently as possible, but also make sure that we're designing a high enough quality product to be accepted by the market. In the event that more inventory comes on, you must stand out with design. So that's my own number one personal action item. Second action item I have has to do with interest rates. So the interest rates are historically low. I'm in the process of refinancing anything. If it's a 1 point difference that I can get on any kind of a mortgage, I'm trying my best, as long as I don't have prepayment penalties on my existing mortgages, to refinance them and lock them in wherever possible, ideally for as long of a term as possible. So that's my second action item, is to take advantage of the low interest rates. And then my plan is, okay, let's welcome with open arms the inflation that is probably coming down the pike for the other two. And, you know, my third action item is to hold all of my assets through that, because if, you know, the dollar is weakening, essentially the sales of the companies that I own and the rents of the properties that I own, and I don't own thousands of properties, so I'm not at the whim of, let's say, the economic forces of buying into REITs or something where I have more of a market of scale. Mine are more of a direct, very carefully selected assets that I'm tightly managing. But, you know, I'm seeing the rents climb up. So now I'm paying off my own debts on my property, which I've locked in at a lower interest rate, and I'm paying those off with inflated dollars a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, ideally. And I'm happy that I did buy, you know, then, meaning back then, if I'm hanging on to my assets. When I say hold on to my assets as well, again, buying into any kind of company, stocks, any other kind of a passive investment, I want to hang on to those for 3 to 5 years. And if the inflation comes, ideally it's inflating the price of my assets as well when I look back. And that's a way for me, to kind of take advantage of that current system. And then like my fourth action item is kind of the same one as my third, which was hold all the assets. But it was more of a targeted buy and hold strategy. So we talk a lot, you and I, when we get together, Paul, we talk a lot about like a broad sweeping, here are the effects. You know, we kind of take the country at large, even the world at large. But you got to remember, all of us who are real estate investors at the granular level. And what I mean is we're actually buying the dirt and the bricks ourselves, and we're going to closing ourselves. It's not that we're investing in a fund, but when we're investing in real estate at the granular level, take a look at the micro markets, right? No matter what area we're in, for the most part, we can often kind of dissect and find these certain zip codes, tracks, portions of the city that are kind of in the path of progress, or maybe even out, in the suburbs in the path of progress. But there's certain targeted niche markets that still will work for a buy and hold, and we'll still see increased rents. And there may not be this type of niche in every city, but the good news is that you can also look around the rest of the country and find a city that does work. So that's my own action item, is to pay attention to very targeted buy and holds to kind of get ahead of this expected inflation that might come, so that I can, in a sense, capitalize on it. Sound like a couple of good action items, Paul?
Yeah, those sound all good. I would agree to lock in long-term money today as much as possible at low rates, especially if you have assets you're planning on holding with a, 10-year time horizon. I would definitely, because you're going to benefit from inflation over the next decade. And I would agree that all real estate is local, okay? And you really need to know your local market. And you need to know which areas you should buy in, which areas you shouldn't. You should know where the development is coming so that you can buy ahead of the development. All those are really good points. And I agree with you on the housing market slowdown. If you have a property that somebody can buy and it requires no investment, when they buy it, it will sell. There is no question. But I think especially when it comes to millennials, there is this kind of trend that they want everything done for them. And I remember my first house, and my first house was a fixer-upper, and I did a lot of that fixer-upping, even though I'm not a real estate guy. And so I don't think that that's necessarily the approach of most millennials. In fact, I know it isn't, because statistically I can show this. And I also know this anecdotally from a lot of people. So part of what you have to think about is we are going into what I would call a more normalized real estate market, where especially for individual homes, it's going to be more like it's going to take a certain amount of time on the market. What is the buyer going to have to do after they buy the house? Is it a couple of minor things, or is it some real investment? And I agree that the houses that require real fix-up are going to just sit on the market longer. And I would say that all portions of your strategy are valid, given what's coming. And the only thing I would add to this, Dan, is that I would keep just a pool of capital sitting around, I don't know, 10% of your capital, 20% of your capital, sitting around for opportunities that are going to pop up over the next 12 to 18 months. Because a lot of the foreclosure activity has been delayed. A lot of the commercial foreclosure activity has been delayed. And it's all coming. And once it comes, some of those properties will be very attractive and available at extremely attractive prices. So that would be my comment on what you said, Dan.
All right. So how can listeners get more info about you, Paul, or Green Drake Advisors?
Well, they can always get more info about me. They can go online, search me, or they can go to our website, www.greendrakeadvisors.com, and we always have a contact us form on the website that they're more than welcome to fill out, or they can call the office here at 610-687-7766, and they can set up an appointment to chat with me. And they can also request our monthly newsletter, where we put out our words of wisdom for people. And those would be the best ways to get in touch with us. And I'd be happy to talk to any of your listeners and give them advice on specific things they're thinking to do.
All right. Well, hey, once again, I've had a great episode. Got 4 pages of notes here myself. I thank you, Paul, for coming on the show.
And thank you for having me, Dan. And I look forward to doing a catch-up call sometime in the middle of next year.
That'll work. Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these 2 facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And 2, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at FundRehabDeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1-minute sign-up process right now, so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. And thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Remember to also check out the episode archives of Wealth Building Real Estate Investment Jewels of Wisdom at reidiamonds.com. My main business, Diamond Equity Investments, is that of buying, renovating, and selling houses. 223 deals closed in 2019 and 247 houses bought and sold so far in 2020. We currently have another 135 houses in inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold and awaiting closing. So here's how you and I can do business. Number one, we operate in Atlanta, Chicago, and the Philadelphia region. Before we begin construction, we offer our houses, our inventory, for sale at wholesale pricing. Go to dealswithroi.com. At that site, you can also review our current career postings when we're looking to add team members or sign up for the local buyers list. That site, again, is dealswithroi.com. Number two, if you're an accredited investor and you enjoy double-digit returns on your capital and might consider passively funding a deal of mine, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails. And number three, finally, if you have a deal for sale in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We have reached the end, my friend. Next up, we have Jacksonville, Florida real estate investor and turnkey rental property provider, Greg Cohen, joining us with his unique perspective on what's happening with Florida's residential real estate market. Until then, keep closing deals.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.